You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 377, Revelation 9. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Well, I have a pug update. Okay. The pugs have now been introduced to the pool properly.
And with life jackets?
With life jackets, of course. And yeah. their attitude toward the pool has moved from hysteria to mild hysteria. they didn't like it. But, you know, they took it a notch down because after flapping around in the pool, you know, and we held them up. We didn't just throw them in there, you know. But they were willing to stand in the water on the top step. It goes about halfway up a pug. So I think they'll still like it to cool off. But I don't expect to see them swimming laps anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, that's a big step if they'll at least stand in it.
Yeah.
Do y'all let the pugs out, run around in the backyard when y'all are in the house and whatnot, or are y'all always out in the backyard?
Yeah, no, we let them out. We let them out now. We know they're not going to jump in, so
that's my fear.
Sufficiently spooked.
Yeah. That's why I don't let my dog, or we don't try to get him to like the pool, because I don't want to have to think about him jumping in the pool when he's out there by himself and whatnot. So I'm glad that our dog does not like to swim. He hates it.
Yeah. So if they ever got to like it, then we just have to, you know, we'd have to just put the life jacket on and sort of leave it on, you know, unless we do it like in the evening when we're going to bring them in, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But the in and out thing, we'd have to leave it on. But there's no danger of that right now.
And it's, you know, as we approach summer, how many times, I'm going to say the over under for visits to the beach by you is 1.5, and I'm going to go under. How many times you've been to the beach?
Well, I've not been there yet.
Exactly.
I almost went this weekend, and I told Drina I would do that, but then she changed her mind and they made some other plan, you know. My daughter was down here, and so that wiped that off. So well, I'm still at zero.
I'm going to leave that over under at 1.5 for the whole summer. And we're going to revisit and see how many times you made it to the beach since you live a few miles away from it.
Yeah. So, okay, what counts as going to the beach? Like
your
like
feet
physically
hit the sand.
Walking on the beach?
Yeah, your feet what? Hit the sand.
Okay, got to hit the sand. All right.
You got to touch the sand.
All right.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, if you're driving by it or you're parked in the parking lot, that doesn't count. You got to. Your feet have to hit the
I
sand.
I asked because of the parking lot, because, you know, you'll get sand in the parking lot, but there's like a fence, you know, so pass beyond the threshold there, that's what
exactly.
Counts,
okay. The sand has to be on sand, not on concrete. It doesn't count. It has to be literally on the natural occurring sand to count.
All right. Well,
and you can't game it either. So you can't be into the summer and you're like, I haven't been to the beach yet, so I want to win this over. And then you just go despite the total, because that's cheating.
No, I won't do that. If I get forced to go or talked into going and for some other reason, then we'll count that.
Yeah, you can count that. Okay, all right, there you go, folks.
Okay,
if you live in the Jacksonville area, keep an eye out for an Heiser spotting. You know, keep your binoculars.
Yeah.
And let me know.
Well, I don't think I'll be too conspicuous. So maybe the person that has no tan at all or something like that, but hey, probably won't count because there are plenty of people who visit it.
I saw a few pictures of you wearing shorts now, so I know you're wearing shorts on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'll wear shorts if it gets hot.
Yeah, there you go. All right. It's good stuff, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, this is riveting, I know. It's just, you know, this is why people tune in, these sorts of details.
Oh, yeah. We ought to see how long we can go, because for the people who fast forward, I want them to accidentally get some of this talk. You know, they skip. Gosh, another 30 seconds.
We can do like
30 more seconds. So keep talking.
No, we could do like musical interludes, and then we start talking about this stuff. Like that'll trap them, you know, because they won't know when it begins or ends. We could do that.
That's what we're about, forcing people to listen to our chatter.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Mike. Well, hey, we've got an entire chapter all by itself today.
Yes, we do. We're not divvying up anything. This is Revelation 9. And, you know, for those people out there who, you know, have not been already mesmerized by our preliminary chat here, try to come out of that. We're going to get back to the biblical stuff here. For those of you who have read Reversing Hermon, you've been introduced to my thoughts very briefly in relation to Revelation 9, specifically about the locusts, you know, that come out of the pit and so on and so forth. We're going to get into that today. So there, I have, you know, said and written something about Revelation 9 prior to today, but we're going to, you know, as the series dictates, we're going to go through the whole chapter and look at Old Testament backdrops and antecedents and points of origin for what we read in Revelation 9. So I'm going to cut it in half. The whole chapter goes through trumpets 5 and 6. And it's kind of neatly divisible. The first 12 verses really deal with trumpet 5. So let's just jump in there. And then when we, you know, hit verse 13, we'll be on trumpet 6. So ESV, I'm just going to read through these 12 verses here so we have it in our heads. The fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold, and their faces were like human faces, their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lion's teeth, and they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails and stings like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon. The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. So that's the end of verse 12. This is trumpet 5. And again, we're not commenting on, you know, end times systems and sort of goofy interpretations. Let me just, you know, make one little comment about that. These are not, you know, tanks and missiles and things like that, because, quote, again, they were there to torment or harm, again, the people on the earth. And here's where we get in verse 5. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. I would suggest to you that if this is a tank or a missile, people are going to die. Okay, so right away, the literal interpretation, even without getting into the Old Testament imagery, is sort of ridiculous. And again, I don't think that's going to surprise anyone. What might surprise people is how deeply this imagery is embedded or can be drawn from the Old Testament. So that's what we're going to get into. Now, we're going to start in the first verse here. You know, a star fallen from heaven to earth, okay? At the beginning of the fifth trumpet. Now, there are two approaches to identifying this fallen star. And I think this is worth getting into. We're going to traverse into Second Temple literature here. And some of this is going to be a little bit familiar from some things we've had before, you know, up until Revelation 9 about falling stars and this sort of imagery. But I want to zero in on a couple of things here very specifically. So there are two approaches to answering the question, well, who or what is this? The context at least makes obvious that this is a supernatural being. Okay, that much nobody really argues about. The points of controversy, though, are as follows. There's three of them. First question is this being a good angel, in God's service, you know, a supernatural being loyal to God, or a fallen, evil, celestial being, perhaps even Satan himself. So that's the first question. Question number two, is this fallen star with, quote, the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit, unquote, the same as the angel of Revelation 20, verse 1, which says, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain, unquote. Third question, if one opts for the fallen star being evil, is that fallen star the same being as Abaddon in Revelation 9:11, you know, 10 verses later? So those are the three sort of fundamental questions you get from the very first verse. And I'm going to go through a couple of approaches here to this. In terms of a first approach, On, in his commentary, takes the view that the fallen star of Revelation 9:1 is an angel, but is not the angel of 9:11. So the celestial being of verse 1 is not Abaddon of verse 11. That he is an angel, On, you know, argues, is based on the parallel passage in Revelation 20, verse 1. Okay? I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a chain. So he says, if you look at Revelation 21, it's so similar to 9:1, it's pretty obvious that this is a supernatural being and an angel. He further argues that the angel mentioned in 9:11 renames Abaddon. In other words, he is Abaddon. So the one in 9:11 is the angel mentioned there is Abaddon. The angel mentioned in 9:11 is not this first angel of Revelation 9:1. So that's On's view, and he writes this. He says, John does not say that he actually saw the star fall. He says only that he saw the star after it had fallen. In 9:1 and 2, it becomes obvious that the star is a supernatural being, in other words, an angel. In early Jewish literature, stars can represent angelic beings. And this is obvious. Judges 5:20, Job 38:7, Daniel 8:10, so on and so forth. Falling stars, says On, often represent evil angelic beings or demons. And he has a slew of quotes here, just a few. 1 Enoch 86:3, 88:1, 90:24, Testament of Solomon 20, verses 14 through 17, and Jude 13. But could also be Satan. 1 Enoch 86:1, again, the apocalypse of Elijah 4:11, Luke 10:18, that's the I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven, and Revelation 12:9. Again, this falling language is his point. Here, the fallen star should be understood as an angelic messenger, Allah, Revelation 20, verse 1, and not be identified with the angel of the abyss named Abaddon or Apollyon in 9:11. The angel is named only here in Revelation, and elsewhere in the Old Testament and early Jewish literature is mentioned only in 4Q 2:80. In other words, let me just break in here. He's saying that we only get the name Abaddon. Okay, the angel of 9:11 is named only here, and then in some early Jewish literature. Again, specifically 4Q 2:80, which is a Dead Sea Scroll, actually references the angel of the pit, the spirit of Abaddon. Okay, back to On. While in 4Q 2:80 and related texts, these two titles are alternate ways of describing Belial, who would be the Satan figure in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In Revelation, it is not at all clear that the angel of the abyss is a designation for Satan, for he is carefully named elsewhere with a selection of aliases. In two different contexts, Revelation 12:9, Revelation 20, verse 2. And neither Abaddon nor the angel of the abyss is mentioned again. The fact that angelon, in the Greek word there, is articular, it has the definite article, suggests that the author expected the readers to be familiar with this angel. In other words, that the angel of the abyss is none other than Satan Belial. He's saying that's possible. Abaddon is a Hebrew term for the kingdom of the dead. Again, Proverbs 15:11, Job 26:6, Job 28:22, Job 31:12, you know, reference this term Abaddon with, you know, the realm of the dead. It's used as a poetic parallel to Sheol, Job 26:6, Proverbs 15:11 again, 27:20, and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's used as a term associated with death, Job 28:22, in the grave, Psalm 88:11, Masoretic text, it's verse 12, and so on and so forth. So he's saying, you know, could be, you know, Abaddon could be, you know, Satan. We don't know, but he's saying that Abaddon is different. The angel there, the angel who is called Abaddon, is different than the one in 9:1. Now, the key sentence, you know, in all that to parse in On's thinking is, quote, here the fallen star should be understood as an angelic messenger based on Revelation 20, verse 1, and not be identified with the angel of the abyss named Abaddon. Now, I take this as indicating On sees a good angel in both 9:1, Revelation 9:1, and 20, verse 1. Others, you know, who are commenting on On's work say that, you know, they'll argue that On still thinks the angel of Revelation 9:1 is evil, even though it's not Abaddon. And they draw that conclusion based on On's comments about falling star language being used of evil angels. I don't think On actually says that, and I don't read him that way. Now, here's why it matters. The advantage, interpretively, of having a good angel in both Revelation 9:1 and Revelation 20, verse 1, is consistency. There's no indication that the angel of Revelation 20, verse 1, who holds the key to the abyss, is evil. There's no indication he's evil. And after all, he's going to bind Satan. That's his mission in Revelation 20, verse 1. So if the angel of Revelation 9:1 was evil, while the one in 20, verse 1 is good, what you'd have is you'd have two different angels with keys to the abyss. And that seems to make little sense to me. And we'll return to that thought in a moment. But in my reading of On here, we have a good angel in both 9:1 and 20, verse 1. That angel being the same entity. It's the same angel. Again, this is how, in this approach, this is how you could understand it. Same angel in 9:1 and 20, verse 1. In fact, you know, they're not only both good, it's the same one. But he has two different missions. In Revelation 9:1, the angel's mission is one of release, the release of the forces under the command of Abaddon, a different figure mentioned in 9:11. And in Revelation 21, the same angel has the mission of coming back to the abyss again, and this time he binds Satan. All right? So as far as an identification, more specifically, of this angel, the one in 9:1 and the one also in 20, verse 1, the one who has the key, again, to the abyss, to the pit, the best candidate is Uriel, who is the archangel who in 1st Enoch was actually called the chief over Tartarus. Again, Tartarus is a reference to the abyss where the watchers are held. And you get that from 1st Enoch 19:1 and 1st Enoch 20 verse 1. Now, another option, which is weaker in my view, is this angel could be Sarakael, which is another angel in 1st Enoch who was, quote, over the spirits who sin in the spirit, unquote. I just don't think that's as good of a candidate because Uriel is specifically associated with the pit, which is known as Tartarus. Now, Beale objects to both of these options, both of these, you know, Uriel, Sarakael, and all this stuff, because he says 1st Enoch never calls either one of them a fallen star, but reserves that language for evil fallen angels. So Beale rejects the idea totally that the angel of Revelation 9:1 is a good angel. So that brings us to the second view. Okay, so you know, if you're gonna see the angel in Revelation 9 as an evil being, that takes you in different territory. And this is where Beale is at. So Beale, in his commentary, he discusses the issue of good or bad fallen star entity in Revelation 9:1 this way. Honestly, I think he gets in his own way here, but we'll unpack why. He says, this fallen star image has been given various identifications. The main debate is whether this is a good or evil being. It could either be the archangel Uriel, who was chief over Tartarus, or the archangel Sarakael, who was over the spirits who sin in the spirit. And he references Enoch. But 1st Enoch never calls these figures fallen stars, either one of them. Instead, this description is reserved exclusively for fallen angels under the confinement of the archangels. The star should rather be interpreted in the same way as the star in 8:10 because of the parallel wording, a star fell from heaven, unquote. So that's Beale's short take on this. Now, the question has to be asked. Let's go to Revelation 8:10. I'm going to read this to you because he uses this as part of his justification. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch, and it fell on the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. That was where I threw in, you know, verse 11 there too. So, you know, he's interpreting that as an evil fallen entity. So we have to ask, though, in relation to that verse, Revelation 8:10, as to why an evil angel would fall from heaven. Like, is this his fall from grace? Like, what does the fall language actually mean? And why would he do it when another angel blows the trumpet? Because it sounds like if this fallen star, this Wormwood, is a celestial being, okay, not an asteroid or something, if this is a celestial being, why is he apparently obeying the trumpet call of another angel if he's evil? Why can't this be an obedient angel wreaking chaos in judgment, just like the angels who wreaked the plagues back in Egypt did, again in Psalm 78, you know, I think it's 49 and 50. If there's truly a parallel with the Exodus material, which there kind of obviously is, then why can't the parallel encompass this point? In other words, why can't the parallel also encompass the character, the nature of the angel? I mean, back in Egypt, you know, a whole company of angels, according to Psalm 78, were mediating the plagues. And if the plagues are the clear parallel, and they are, to these trumpets, including the one back in chapter 8, why can't we conclude that this, you know, again, entity in chapter 8 is a good guy? And Beale's answer is going to be, well, he's referred to as fallen. The argument extends from this one word, even though the parallel characterization doesn't call for that particular characterization of the angels involved back at the Exodus. But anyway, let's go back to some other problems. Again, if the angel of 9:1, Revelation 9:1, is evil because of the fallen language, well, is the angel of Revelation 20, verse 1, also evil? Now, in Revelation 21, the word fallen doesn't occur. There's different language, okay, in Revelation 20, verse 1. So the specific word fallen is absent, but yet they both have, you know, the keys to the abyss. So if they're two different angels, in other words, the one in Revelation 21, if Beale says, well, that's a good guy because John doesn't use the word fallen there, then again, now we wind up with a situation where we have two angels, both with the key to the pit. Are there two keys? Maybe there are two keys. Maybe they each have one. Or do the angels hand it off like a hall pass? And if the first angel is evil, why does he respond to the trumpet call? Why obey God's judgment call? Why, if you're an angel in rebellion, why are you obeying now? Again, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And Beale doesn't address any of these questions. So honestly, I'm skeptical of his skepticism on this point. There's really no problem with having a good angel release the watchers. And again, I think these guys are the watchers because it's part of their day of judgment. It's not a jailbreak. They're being released ultimately to their own doom. This is initiating, again, Day of the Lord stuff, the sequence of events. Now, Justin Bass chimes in here a little bit. I mean, his book on the keys of death and Hades, it's not specifically about these passages, but he says a few things in passing. But unfortunately, it doesn't really resolve these issues. He writes that the verb, you know, about the key, that the key is given. It's a passive, you know, reference, okay? He writes that the verb here in reference to the angel of 9:1 being given the key to the abyss, quote, occurs 21 times in Revelation and is used twice as much in reference to evil agents than in reference to good agents. Then he lists the verses where it's a good guy, and he lists the verses where it's a bad guy. Now, the flaw there is the fact that the verb form under discussion is in fact used of good agents. It's used of good guys. So that undermines using the verb form as a criterion for determining that the angel of Revelation 9:1 is evil. The exegetical answer to this question is not determined by a head count, by a numerical count. That's not how exegesis is done. You don't do numerical counts, okay? And Bass isn't claiming that. He's just making the observation. There's also another logical flaw to having the angel of Revelation 9:1 as an evil being, one revealed by understanding what the abyss is. And we'll get to this other logical flaw in a moment, but let's talk about the abyss. Now, ESV has, you know, it references the bottomless pit or the pit. The English phrase bottomless pit is a rendering of Greek abusos, which is abyss, okay? Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3, have the same term as being the place where Satan dwells, and so it can be understood as a partial synonym for Hades, at least a partial synonym. It's hard to know how much it overlaps, but it overlaps some, at least. So it's a partial synonym for Hades, that is the place, not the personified being that we talked about weeks ago when we were on the keys passage. And so it can be understood as a partial synonym also for the realm of the dead. Now, a quote here, again, from Owen in Revelation, his Revelation commentary. He writes, "In Revelation, the beast ascends from the abyss," Revelation 11, 7, 17, 8, "and it is also the abode of Satan," Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3, "of the angel of the abyss, Abaddon or Apollyon," Revelation 9, 11, "and also of demons," Revelation 9, 1 through 10. So, again, this clearly, again, the abyss thing sounds like it's the realm of the dead and where Satan lives and all that kind of stuff. Now, that there's a reason why I say partial. We'll get to that right now. In 1 Enoch 10, 12 to 13, the abyss, the abusos, it's the same term in the Greek text here of Enoch. This is the place where the offending watchers, or the sons of God of Genesis 6, 1 through 4, are imprisoned, quote, for 70 generations, unquote. The partially synonymous relationship between the abyss and the realm of the dead is indicated by the fact that some members of the abyss are imprisoned and they're unable to leave. That would be the watchers from Genesis 6. Whereas others, Satan and demons, are not imprisoned. So there can't be a complete total overlap between the abyss and the realm of the dead. It's better to view the abyss as some sort of compartment or, you know, subset or something. Part of, you know, a neighborhood, okay, a subset location of the realm of the dead. Enoch, in the book of Enoch, actually visits the abyss in 1 Enoch 21, 7 through 10. I'll read this to kind of give you a flavor for how Jews would have thought of the abyss. This is why I'm getting into Second Temple literature, because John is using the same terminology. And again, this is no surprise. John has referenced Enoch and Enochian material before. But here's 1 Enoch 21, 7 through 10. It says, "I then proceeded," Enoch, you know, narrating this, "from that area to another place which is even more terrible, and saw a terrible thing, a great fire that was burning and flaming. The place had a cleavage that extended to the last sea, pouring out great pillars of fire. Neither its extent nor its magnitude could I see, nor was I able to estimate. At that moment, what a terrible opening is this place and a pain to look at. Then Uriel, one of the holy angels who was with me," again, remember Uriel's the one, you know, who's supervising this place, "responded and said to me, 'Enoch, why are you afraid like this?' I answered and said, I am frightened because of this terrible place and the spectacle of this painful thing.' And he said to me, 'This place is the prison house of the angels.'" Again, specifically, it's going to be a reference to the watchers in context. "They are detained here forever." Again, forever, again, you probably know that the forever language here and elsewhere just means a very long time, because elsewhere in Enoch, it's going to be 70 generations and unto the time of the end or something like that. You know, there's other ways, other phrases that are used of this place and their punishment. So this abyss then is, this is the chief parallel to the lake of fire alluded to in Revelation 20, verse 10, and also Matthew 25, 41, you know, "made for the devil and his angels," you know, that phrase. This is the place of the final judgment, ultimately, of both human unbelievers and, again, the devil and his angels. Now, this overlap points to this other point of incongruence with Beale's notion that the angel of Revelation 9, 1 is evil. Now, here's the point. If Jesus, I mean, think back to our earlier episode, when we talked about Revelation 1:18 and Revelation, let me just look up the phrase death in Hades. So it's in one of these episodes. It's the episode on Revelation 1:18. Revelation 1:18 is where we get the reference to death and Hades. And we discussed that verse in relationship to, let's look up the word keys, because there was two of them in Revelation. And also Revelation 3, verse 7. So the episodes where we talk about the keys of death and Hades, and you know, in Revelation 3, it's the key of David. I believe it is the episode on Revelation 3, because we deferred talking about the keys of death and Hades till we got to the second key reference. But you recall from that episode, when we talked about the keys of death and Hades, Jesus took them. He took the keys of death and Hades from, if you remember the discussion, from those personified entities, okay, death and Hades. Hades wasn't just the place. in that discussion in these passages. These places have a personification of an evil supernatural being called death, okay, and Hades. And Jesus takes the keys from them. In other words, he is now the master of life and death because of, you know, he descends there. This is one of the things he does. And of course, he rises from the dead. So if that's the case, it makes zero sense for Jesus to hand the key back to an evil agent in Revelation 9:1 or anywhere else. So again, this is why I am simply not persuaded of Beale's position. Regardless of the fallen language, again, he's too focused on this one verb, not verb, but this one adjective, and he's not considering the wider context, especially, you know, the keys of death and Hades and who holds them. It just makes no sense. It makes no sense at all. Because not only would you have Jesus giving the keys back, like, why would he do that? It destroys the imagery and the theology of what that means. But you also now have either a situation where you've got two evil angels, they each have keys, or there's a good one and a bad one, they each have keys, or they pass the keys from one to... It just doesn't make any sense. It's far better, again, to just have one good angel in Revelation 9:1, Revelation 21, who has the single key. Again, if the angel is loyal to God and loyal to the risen Christ, again, then you could see it makes sense to have that, you hand that key to the angel and say, go unlock, you know, the abyss, or go do this and that. It doesn't make any sense if you're handing it over to a rebel. Zero. Few other items. The abyss is also an Old Testament metaphor for chaos. We should mention this because, again, this is good Old Testament imagery. Owen writes, the term abusos means without depth. That's where we get bottomless or fathomless. And it was used to refer to the infinite void or a subterranean region beneath the earth, in accordance with, again, the three-tiered, you know, view of the universe. The term abusos occurs seven times in Revelation. Five of these occur in two passages in which the three-level cosmology of Revelation is implied, specifically Revelation 9:1 through 11 is one, and also Revelation 20 verses 1 through 3. Now, Beale and McDonough, in the commentary on the Old Testament, the New Testament use of the Old Testament, they add this. The abyss in the Septuagint is always related to water, whether it be the chaotic waters, the primeval deep of the creation account. And, you know, obvious reference is Genesis 1:2, but you get Psalm 104, verse 6 in the English. The waters of the sea, again, is another way it's described, Isaiah 63:13, or the waters below the earth, Ezekiel 31:15. Because all of these could be symbolically associated with evil forces. Remember, the sea and waters, you know, these are chaos metaphors in the Old Testament. Since all of these could be symbolically associated with evil forces, however, by New Testament times, the abyss was spoken of more broadly as a place of punishment and or confinement for wicked spirits. Again, and we have all these passages in Enoch and Revelation that we've already quoted. He adds here Jubilees 5:6 through 14, 2 Peter 2:4. Again, that's the reference to Tartarus. 4 Ezra 7:36, and so on. So Beale and McDonough say this is clearly what's in view here. So now, what this means is that, again, we're dealing with, you know, it's a three-tiered cosmology, again, which doesn't conform to a scientific worldview. We talked about this many times before. It also deals with the afterlife and the supernatural world, because this is where spiritual beings live, okay? Either the dead, disembodied dead, or demons, or Satan, or Abaddon, or, you know, these are celestial beings. These are by nature disembodied beings, all of them. So we're not in the physical world anymore. So the three-tiered cosmology isn't like, well, if you dug a hole enough deeply into the earth, you know, you'd find this place. That's false. It doesn't have latitude and longitude. Okay, so that's not what is going on here. And that's why, since it's actually these are all, again, metaphors for the part of the spiritual world where evil exists and is confined, and ultimately the unbelieving dead, or just the, you know, that sort of thing. That's those lines of thought. That's why it can be referred to as watery and also fiery. Okay, because both of those things, especially the water, these are chaos symbols. They are symbols of judgment and death. and something frightening that can harm you, and so on and so forth. This is why you get this seemingly, physically, these things don't pair, water and fire. But it doesn't matter, because we're not talking about a place with latitude and longitude. So I think it's important, again, to bring that out. And I think Beal and McDonough have a nice little paragraph there to summarize that. Now let's get into verse 3, really verses 3 through 10, who or what is released. Now, I've already hinted that I think this is the release of the watchers in prison. Those sons of God from Genesis 6, known as watchers in Second Temple literature, from before the flood. Okay, and I'm not alone here. This is not just Mike. I mean, there are a number of people who this is the view they take. Owen writes, or not Owen, but Stephen Thompson. This is an article, The End of Satan. This is from Andrews University Seminary Studies. It's a 1999 publication. He writes, the most suitable sequel to the time of imprisonment described in 1 Enoch 10, and we just read, we read 1 Enoch 21, but 10 is a lot the same. This is where the watchers are sent. So the most suitable sequel to the time of imprisonment described in 1 Enoch 10 can be found in Revelation 9, where the key to the abyss is given to a fallen star or to the fifth trumpet-blowing angel. He has a question mark there, so it's an ambiguity in his mind. Who uses it? Again, this fallen star uses it to open the shaft to the abyss and facilitate the release of imprisoned demonic forces who emerge to terrorize earth dwellers. That's the end of the quote. And again, frankly, the point is that this is the only group. It's the group from Genesis 6, i.e. the watchers. This is the only group of evil supernatural beings, fallen, sinful supernatural beings, whatever term you want to use, who are imprisoned in all of, in Second Temple Jewish literature. So the fact that they're releasing some from the same place in Revelation 9 really sort of narrows the possibilities as to who these could be. There's clearly a textual relationship, again, between Revelation 9 and Enochian material, Second Temple Jewish material, that has the original offending watchers imprisoned in the pit to await final judgment. Again, this is in Enoch in a number of places, chapter 10, chapter 18, chapter 19, chapter 21, chapter 54, 88, Jubilees 5, again, 2 Peter 2, as we read a few moments ago. And again, 2 Peter 2, 4 is important because it uses the verb tartarao, sent to Tartarus. And Tartarus, according to Enoch, is where the watchers are imprisoned, and that is supervised by Oriel. So the abyss is also home, again, to these guys, but also home to their disembodied offspring, the demons, disembodied giants, again, who were killed. And again, this is familiar territory if you've read Unseen Realm of the Demons book. The main source here is Archie Wright. His book on the origin of evil spirits. You also get Wallen's book on unclean spirits that I reference in my demons book. Again, there's just a truckload of material on this, going through Second Temple Jewish literature to talk about the origin of demons being the disembodied spirits of the giants. Okay, the descendants of the Nephilim in that regard. You get the Rephaim show up in Sheol in Isaiah 14:9. You've got a reference in Luke 8:31, which is kind of interesting. Let's go to Luke 8:31 real quickly. This is the Legion episode, and the demons who come out, cast out by Jesus. In verse 31, they begged him, Jesus, not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now, it wouldn't make any sense if they begged him not to depart to where they live, but specifically, it's the abyss. Okay, this is the prison. It's not bad if you get sent home. It's real bad if you get sent to the prison, because then you can't get out. So again, there's a reference. Again, this is very consistent. The New Testament is part of the Second Temple environment. We all know this, but the literature is actually very consistent. This whole subject, by the way, where do demons come from? Where the imprisonment of the watchers. This is one of the very few subjects in Second Temple Jewish literature where basically all the texts agree. That is really unusual, but this is one where you've got overwhelming agreement on this issue. So again, you've got the watchers in here. Again, you've got demons in the realm of the dead, but specifically in the abyss. Again, the prison. Again, that's a very specific group. It's the offending watchers. But Satan and these other dudes, these other rebels, are in the realm of the dead. Okay, but the abyss is a special compartment in hell, as it were. Again, it's a prison. So onto the way they're characterized. As I wrote in Reversing Hermon, the bizarre description of the beings released from the abyss as locusts, it's verse 3, that were, quote, like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, the hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lion's teeth, verses 7 and 8. That description does not undermine their identification as the fallen watchers, because hybridized theriomorphic, that's an academic term that means animal-shaped or animal-like, descriptions applied to demonic spirits are common in ancient Jewish and classical literature. Again, this is just a way that supernatural evil spirits are described to try to convey their voraciousness, their violence, their ugliness, their freakishness. Okay, all these things. This is how writers would describe features and facets, character portraits. This is a profile. These are contributing elements to a profile of the nature of these beings. And so they use animal imagery. Okay, this is not uncommon. Now, on the imagery, Beale and McDonough, again in the commentary on the New Testament use of the Old Testament, note Old Testament connections to the appearance of these locusts, again, which textually, there's only one candidate, the fallen watchers. Okay. The portrayal, let me just say it, it's the fallen watchers, and again, they're, you know, the disembodied spirits of the watchers are also, you know, in the same realm, but again, it's the watchers that are not allowed to move, they're not allowed out. So just so, you know, we're clear on that. They write, the portrayal in Revelation 9:7-9 is based on Joel 1:2, which describes a plague of locusts devastating Israel's land. And the cross reference there is Jeremiah 51:27. The locust judgment in Joel 2 is introduced and concluded with the phrase, get this, sound the trumpet. That's Joel 2:1 and Joel 2:15. Is that ringing a bell? This judgment in Joel is modeled on the plague of locusts in Exodus 10. Jewish tradition held that in Sheol and in Abaddon were the, quote, angels of destruction, who were in authority over thousands of scorpions. Again, that's, you know, Jewish tradition, rabbinic stuff. Now we're getting into Ginsberg, the legends of the Jews. This is Beale and McDonough's source. So this is rabbinic talk here. This is not Second Temple. It's not, you know, Old Testament. Ginsberg notes that the sting of the scorpions of the, you know, that were supposedly, you know, thought to be in rabbinic tradition, okay, in this place, the sting of the scorpions was lethal. However, some of the stings don't kill, but only torment the inhabitants of hell. And if you have Ginsberg, Legends of the Jews, that's pages, it's volume 1, pages 11 through 16, and volume 2, page 312. Now, in his commentary, Beale's own commentary, not with McDonough, but Beale's own commentary, he adds another thought about, he says, the Testament of Solomon 2, verses 2 through 4, speaks of demons who have wings and fly and resemble human-like lions. So there you get the lion teeth element. Now, all of that hardly captures. It barely captures the Old Testament antecedents. I'm going to read a long excerpt from Beale's commentary, and even this is partial. I just want to give you a flavor of how much Old Testament backdrop imagery there is to the description of these, of the released watchers. Again, these released supernatural prisoners that exist. I mean, there's just a lot. There's a truckload of stuff. And I'm doing this, again, to telegraph the point that I've already did at the beginning. We're not talking about helicopters and surface-to-air missiles and laser. We're not talking about any of that. All of this stuff comes from the Old Testament somewhere. And even Joel 1 and 2, the locust, you know, the sound of the trumpet. Okay, and how much more explicit could it be? Okay, but here we go. Beale writes, in exercising this power, the locusts execute judgment, as has already been intimated by their association with smoke. Could Isaiah 14:29-31 also stand in the background? This is the flying serpents, okay? Since it strikingly portrays an enemy who will oppress and demoralize unbelieving Philistia as a flying serpent associated with smoke. The harmful nature of the judgment of Revelation 9:3 is also expressed by the description of the beings here as locusts going out, quote, into the earth. They are destructive as a swarm of locusts devouring all vegetation in their path. The wording of this expression is based on Exodus 10:12, quote, let the locust come up on the land and the earth, unquote, which introduces the locust plague against Egypt. Therefore, the fifth trumpet is partly modeled literally and thematically on the Exodus plagues, as were the preceding trumpets. The locusts in Exodus 10:15 destroyed the land, devoured the red vegetation, all the fruit of the trees. There was no green thing left on the trees, unquote. But here the locusts are commissioned not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or tree. They are to harm only unbelievers, quote, those who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads, unquote, but have the mark of the beast on the forehead. It's Revelation 13, 16, and 17. Deuteronomy 28 also predicts that, quote, in the latter days, unquote, Israel will suffer the plagues of Egypt, including the plague of locusts, because of idolatry. Detailed description is now given of the locusts. The use of likeness, hamoi oma, and the repeated like, hamoi os, in verses 7 to 10, expresses the inability of John to describe precisely what he has seen. He just says they're like this or that. The vision sparks in his mind similar scenes from the Old Testament, as the following verses reveal, and his approximate portrayal of what he has seen is based on his understanding of how the vision relates to the Old Testament prophetic tradition. The portrayal in verses 7 through 9 is based, again, on Joel 1 and 2, which describes the plague of locusts devastating Israel's land. Whether the description there is literal or figurative for an invading army is not crucial for the present purposes. Just as here a trumpet has signaled the coming of the locusts, Revelation 9:1, so also in Joel 2, the locust judgment is introduced and concluded with the sound of the trumpet. This judgment in Joel is itself modeled on the plague of locusts in Exodus 10. There are clear allusions in Joel 1 and 2 and 2:2, and if you compare, you can compare those to Exodus 10, 16, and 14. Joel 1, 3, compare Exodus 10, 2. Joel 2, 9, compare Exodus 10, 6. Joel 2, 27, compare Exodus 10, 2, 8, 18, and 22. It is natural, therefore, that John uses Joel to supplement the description from Exodus already alluded to in verses 3 and 5. The locusts are said to be, quote, like horses prepared for battle, unquote. It is hard to know if horses are only one metaphor for the locusts followed by others, or whether all the pictures in verses 7 to 10 are part of a larger horse metaphor. But this ambiguity does not affect the overall meaning. The locusts, or horses, have faces like human faces. Similarly, Joel 2, 4 through 7 describes the locusts there as like the appearance of horses and like war horses, so they run, like a mighty people arranged for battle, like mighty men, like soldiers. Iron breastplates, quote unquote, is a general description of a part of the armor of a soldier or a battle horse. Job 39, 19, and 20. Nahum 3, 17 likens the scaled armor of Assyrian soldiers to the scaled thoraxes of locusts. This may allude partly to Job 39, 19 through 25, which describes a war horse going forth only at the trumpet sound, clothed in terror and in perfect armor. So now we have, again, Job 39, this is me breaking in here, we have Job 39 using the trumpet language and the armor language, you know, the war horse. And who leaps, this is also Job 39, 19 through 25, these horses that are armored and go forth of the trumpet leap like locusts, unquote. The sound of their, that is the locust wings, as the sound of chariots of many horses running into battle alludes to Joel 2, 4 through 5. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, war horses, and so they run like the sound of chariots. They leap on the tops of mountains, arranged for battle. Included likewise are echoes of Jeremiah 51, 14, and 27, quote, I will fill you with people like locusts, and they will cry out. The Targum actually reads here, Beale says, troops of nations who are as many as the locusts, and they will fill up their voice, unquote. The Jeremiah 51 passage also uses the phrase, bring up the horses like bristly locusts. And this allusion is confirmed in that one, Jeremiah 51, 27 is introduced by, again, here we have a third reference, the sound of the trumpet among the nations, unquote. So we've got three references that associate locusts and trumpets from the Old Testament. That's me breaking in here. Back to Beale. He says, in the same way that a trumpet has signaled the coming of locusts here in Revelation, you get these Old Testament passages doing it. Secondly, the second trumpet, back in Revelation 8, 8, and 9, has already alluded to the burned-out mountain cast into the sea, from Jeremiah 51, 25, and 63 and 64. So that we have a continuation of the earlier allusion. Let me just stop there. Beale's saying, look, the earlier trumpets use Jeremiah 51, and this trumpet, number 5, is using Jeremiah 51 as well for the locust stuff. Back to Beale. The third observation he makes is the Septuagint of Jeremiah 51, 27, and 28, 27, in the Septuagint as well, is closer to Revelation than the Hebrew is. Quote, bring up horses against her as a multitude of locusts, unquote. The allusion reinforces the idea that the trumpet woes are directed to a significant degree against idolatrous persecutors outside the church, since Jeremiah 51, 14, and 27 is an announcement of coming vindication for Israel against idolatrous Babylon. Okay, catch that. The context of Jeremiah 51 is Babylon, who has wrongfully come against Israel and its temple. That's Jeremiah 51 and 11. Now, I'm gonna just stop there. Again, this is a fraction. It's a fraction of what Beale has here. It's probably over half, but still. Why go through all of this data? Okay, it might feel a little mind-numbing. Well, here's why. If you're gonna read this passage like it's black helicopters, you might as well just throw out the Old Testament that John is using. Just throw it out. Let's move to Revelation 9, 13 through 21, and this is trumpet number 6, okay, in the time we have left for today. So I'm going to go to Revelation 9 and read. So verse 13, then the sixth angel blew his trumpet, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour, the day, the month, the year, were released to kill a third of mankind. The number of mounted troops was twice 10,000 times 10,000. I heard their number. And this is how I saw the horses in my vision and those who rode them. They wore breastplates, the color of fire and sapphire and of sulfur. And the heads of the horses were like lions' heads, and fire and smoke and sulfur came out of their mouths. And by these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed. By the fire and smoke and sulfur coming out of their mouths. For the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails. For their tails are like serpents with heads. And by means of them they wound. And the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands, nor give up worshiping demons and idols of gold and silver and bronze and stone and wood, which cannot see or hear or walk. Nor did they repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. Basically, they stayed unbelievers. They stayed hostile and to the Lord. So some of this language has already been dealt with in the first part of Trumpet 5 with the description of, again, the hordes that are released. You know, ultimately what you're going to have is again, this describes the release of supernatural evil. Okay, there's no more. The prison is emptied in the abyss for a short time. Ultimately, this is going to lead to a showdown. You know, it is judgment. God uses them as to judge the unbeliever on the earth. And it's also going to lead to the big showdown in Revelation 20, which is going to be their ultimate doom. And that's where sort of everything is going to be wrapped up. So, you know, we don't want to go back and rehearse all that. I want to pick a few things out of here that are different, again, from the first part of Revelation 9. Essentially, what you have described here is that the prison is emptied because now we've got all the players back on the chessboard. The final conflict is going to be a war between all of the supernatural forces of evil and those humans that are loyal to them against God, okay, against Jesus, all right? This is it sets up the ultimate showdown. It's both a spiritual. It's spiritual warfare in its ultimate, and also the target is earth because they're going to surround Jerusalem and all this sort of stuff. So it's the old wars of gods and men, kind of thing going on here. And this is, again, preparatory. So the prisons are emptied. Everybody goes back on the chessboard. And now we're going to end it. Okay, we're going to have this one final showdown. So let's just pick a few things out here of interest in the rest of the way. 9:13. Verse 13, the golden altar. Revelation 9, 13 mentions this altar, which is an object already encountered in the book elsewhere. on, I believe, yes, has a quote here. The term thusiasterion, which is the term translated, you know, altar, occurs 8 times in Revelation, 4 of which refer to the heavenly counterpart of the earthly incense altar, and 4 to the heavenly counterpart of the altar of burnt offerings. Could be either one. Since it is explicitly said that the golden altar is before God, quote unquote, the voice from the four horns of the altar cannot be the voice of God. In Revelation 8:3-5, an angel functioning as a heavenly priest was depicted as standing by the golden altar, and it is possible that this unidentified voice could be his. So that's the end of his quote. So you have a portion, again, of Revelation 9:13 hearkening back again to some of these things. But the altar, again, is new, but again, even that, you know, we've seen before with some of the, you know, the heavenly furnishing and all that stuff, because again, it's the throne room of God. It's, you know, it's temple, you know, and all this stuff, the heavenly temple, so on and so forth. So that's again, the backdrop for that. Again, earlier back in Revelation 8, we talked about this. Revelation 6, we also hit the altar. So you can go back and look at those episodes for more. Now, Beal and McDonald comment about the rivers. We should say something about the rivers. That the four presumably wicked angels are held back at the great river Euphrates evokes the Old Testament prophecy of a northern enemy beyond the Euphrates from whom God would bring to judge sinful Israel. There's a lot of reference to this. I'm just breaking in now. This is the foe from the north idea that I say something about an unseen realm. So you have Isaiah 7:20, Isaiah 8:7-8, Isaiah 14:29-31, you have Jeremiah 1:14-15, Jeremiah 4:6-13, 6:1, and verse 22. I mean, there's just a whole slew. Ezekiel 38:6, 38:15, 39:2, Joel 2:1-11 is part of the enemy from the north. And it's not just the geographical north, if you recall, if you've read Unseen Realm, it's the cosmic north. Okay, Tzafon. Okay, this was the domain of Baal. This is where Baal and his council was. This is language, the Tzafon language of the Old Testament relates not just to human warriors coming down from the Fertile Crescent, okay, to wreak havoc, you know, in real time, all these invading armies that Israel, you know, had to put up with. But it's also the idea that there are cosmic powers to the north. You think of where Ugarit is, and you get the image in Baal's mountain. So it's cosmic evil comes from the quote-unquote north, again, the supernatural north, the celestial north, if you will. So this is what's in view here. Back to Beal and McDonough, they also write, in both cases, okay, this north, in either scenario, the invaders, again, were characterized as a terrifying army on horses and chariots arising from the north. Isaiah 5, Jeremiah 4, Jeremiah 6, Jeremiah 50, Ezekiel 26, 38, 39, so on and so forth. The echoes of Jeremiah 46 are especially strong. Again, in this part of Revelation 9. The description of the creatures in the sixth trumpet echoes Job's portrait of the sea dragon, the symbol of cosmic evil. This enhances the identification of these creatures with Satan and his deceptive work. So it's they're talking there about the serpentine imagery with the horse's tails. Again, very consistent with the sea dragon idea, which again is Leviathan. It's cosmic evil. It's chaos. So while it's clear that the hordes here are demonic, the conclusion, though, should not be used to eliminate the possibility of human armies. Like I said before, that you've really got both going on. Now, I'm going to disagree with Owen here, but I want to quote him just to give you a flavor for what some do with this. He says, the army of 10,000s of 10,000s appears to be a demonic rather than a human army. Huge armies of destroying angels, though not this large, are twice mentioned in the Babylonian Talmud, where it says that 1.2 million angels of destruction punished the Israelites who sinned in the golden calf incident. Well, obviously, there's nothing in the Bible about that. It's just, again, Jewish rabbis making stuff up. But, again, you get the idea. You know, On is saying this is a demonic army. Okay, I would say an entirely demonic army would be inconsistent with Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10. You see, there's the Revelation 20 connection again, back to Revelation 9. Why do I say that? Okay, let's just read Revelation 20. Because I'm going to argue that what's being articulated here, again, is a release of the watchers. You put all the pieces back on the chessboard. And this is an essential element. You know, yep, they're gonna, you know, wreak havoc because this is God. God is ultimately gonna use them to judge those who have the mark of the beast and so on and so forth. But that's just a setup. It's window dressing. Okay, you know, it is like the plagues in that respect, but it's gonna lead to an ultimate showdown at Jerusalem for everything. And that's gonna involve both supernatural forces and human forces, because that's what Revelation 20 has. So it says, when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints, the holy ones, and the beloved city, obviously Jerusalem. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Now that description, okay, just think about it. You have in Revelation 28, you have the more familiar description. Instead of myriads upon myriads and thousands of 10,000s, you have the more familiar, like the sand of the sea. And that coincides, again, with the language of Revelation 9. But in Revelation 20, verses 7 and 10 that we just read, we have nations deceived and Jerusalem being surrounded. That description has all the marks of an earthly army. You know, Revelation 20:10 has the devil deceiving this force. So the army must, at least in part, and I would say perhaps substantially, be understood as human enemies and warriors. The point is that demons don't need to be deceived to march against Jerusalem. It doesn't make any sense. Again, so I think what we have here is both. We've got both going on. Again, back to the old war of gods and men at the final apocalyptic conflict, you know, the Armageddon kind of thing. And I know if you're into prophecy, you're thinking, well, Mike, you know, you're confused. You know, you're it's Revelation 20 and 10. That's after the millennium, and Armageddon's before that. And okay, that's what a theological system tells you. If you want, you know, more information on Ezekiel 38 and stuff like this, go back to the series on Ezekiel and look up the episodes on Ezekiel 38 and 39. And the book of Revelation, there are things in Revelation 20 that occur earlier in the book of Revelation and that attach to Ezekiel 38 and 39, namely Gog and Magog. And at least in this portion of Ezekiel, or with these elements, this is not a linear chronology. It is a reiterative cycling through of the same events. Okay, so I'm not confused. I'm just not following a theological system. What we have here, again, is a description of the characters that are going to, things that are going to be taking shape in two different passages. When we get later in the book of Revelation, you're going to see how these things cycle through and mirror each other. There are things, I'll just telegraph it. There are things in Revelation 8 and 9 and 13 and 17, okay, and 20 that are basically the same. And this is where we get what's called the recapitulation view of Revelation, where we don't have a linear chronology of events in Revelation. We have some linear chronology. I mean, there is a progression, but we also have events that are described in cycles. Describe an event with five or six motifs, and then the same event, five or six motifs, maybe you add another one, gets done later, and then it cycles through a third time and a fourth time. It's like loops. It's like a Ferris wheel, you know, connected. It's not linear. It's like repeated cycles of the same thing. That does happen in the book of Revelation. And if you're used to interpreting Revelation as only a linear chronology, you never even run into that idea, because you've been taught not to see it. Because you've been taught to approach the book as a linear chronology only. And again, that's why you have the theological system you do, and why somebody else has the theological system they do. I don't care about systems, okay? All I care about is how these things hook back into the Old Testament. And again, the passages do bounce off each other. And ultimately, again, as we have the greatest amount of clarity, or I shouldn't say the greatest, but we have a much greater amount of clarity if we take Armageddon not as a conflict over Megiddo sometime during the quote-unquote Great Tribulation, you know, maybe or maybe not Armageddon. Okay, throw all that out. If you understand, you know, Armageddon as a war for Jerusalem, because it's the Hebrew tongue, Har Mageddon, Har Mored, the Mount of Assembly, the place, you know, where God dwells and where you know, God's counsel is. I mean, this is Zion. This is Zion theology from the Old Testament back and forth and, you know, three times over. If you understand it that way, then you can see how some of these things repeat. And it doesn't really matter if we understand all the repetitions. What matters is all of this is building to the climax for Zion. It's a war between supernatural forces and human forces for God's holy city, for Zion, for Jerusalem. That is what the book leads to, this conflict. So again, you can clean up a lot of the clutter, again, that systems develop and all this presumed precision of events and linear chronology. You know, it most of that just doesn't work. If you're looking back at the Old Testament, because these passages that recycle hook into the same Old Testament passages. Again, that's another clue that John is using. In this case, what does he use? He uses Joel 1 and 2. He uses Jeremiah 51, Jeremiah 56, you know, a couple of other things in smaller ways. But he's going to use these passages again elsewhere, and he's already used them in some places. Exodus imagery, we'll see some more of that. John is using a fairly, you know, fairly small set of Old Testament passages, and he keeps dipping into them to describe the same series of events. That's what he's doing here. That's why you see him dipping into the same passages. He's not dipping into them to say something different. And if it's a linear chronology, why would he keep going back to the stuff he's already alluded to? So again, I don't want to get drift into system analysis here and all that, but I know there's going to be some in the audience that just think, you know, when I'm talking about Revelation 20 and I hook that into Armageddon, that I'm hopelessly confused. No, actually I'm not. I'm just not following a system. So I just wanted to add that. So we're going to end here. There's more that we could say, but this brings us really in Old Testament terms to the end of Revelation 9. So next time we're going to hit Revelation 10. Again, we are through six trumpets now. There's one to go, but there's obviously other things that are going to pop up here in the book. And we're going to just keep doing the same thing. What John's doing has deep Old Testament antecedents. And so what are they and what might they indicate? Again, in this case, it's both it's demonic imagery. It's imagery that he and other writers used for supernatural evil beings. But it's also, it doesn't exclude, in fact, I would say in some respects, it certainly would include human armies as well. And if you think back to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, this is the way things work. The human enemies of God, the human empires against God's people are being controlled and manipulated. They are under dominion. They are under judgment. They are being held, again, captive, enslaved by supernatural, quote-unquote, princes, to use Daniel's language in Daniel 10. But that language is drawn from Deuteronomy 32, the judgment at Babel. And if you've read Unseen Realm, this is all familiar to you. If you haven't, you need to go read the book just to get up to speed here. But with that, we're going to end here and on to Revelation 10.
Yeah, when I first learned to not read Revelation in a linear fashion, that was a big concept for me.
It was for me. Yeah. You know, because I was taught the other way very, very thoroughly. And I think you get both in the book, but the important thing is don't assume the linear approach, because you're just going to run into places where it's not really a good way to go.
And you also referenced Justin Bass, who we're going to have him on our show here several weeks from now, but we do plan on interviewing him.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. You know, do some other things. We'll dip back into his book with the keys a little bit, but he's done some other things too we want to talk about.
All right, Mike, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.